great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking with you about homes, home remodeling and repair, and about, well, about the size of homes. You know what? The typical American home is about 2,600 feet. The typical small or tiny house is between 100 and 400 square feet. And that may be too small for most of us, or many of us at least, but smaller homes can help you live simpler and more efficient. And we'll be talking about small homes today to start the show with our two guests, Chad Spate, the owner of Chad's Design Build. Chad, great to have you back with us.
Thanks, Larry. Always a pleasure to be here.
And John Stefani. John is a program director and instructor at Madison Area Technical College in their construction and remodeling program. He brings 30-plus years of experience in the building industry and never met a house he didn't like. Is that right, John?
It's absolutely true, Larry. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, it's great to have you both here. So we'll talk about the advantages of tiny homes and maybe the disadvantages. And then, of course, we'll also take your other home improvement questions as well. So join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And John, tell us what you do at Madison Area Technical College, and what do students learn there?
Well, we're a one-year diploma program at Madison Area Tech Colleges, and most of the technical colleges throughout the state have a program similar to ours. We teach anybody who comes to how to become a light wood frame carpenter. We teach them soup to nuts, everything from how to frame a small house to finish it on the exterior, finish it on the interior. We teach them estimating. We teach them lots of different stuff. It's a one-year diploma, so if you go full-time, you graduate. And then people like Chad will hire our graduates and bring them on as a support carpenter. You can also go on to do many other things. And we are desperate for students because almost every single one of our grads finds great jobs, most of them even before they even finish the program.
Oh, and Chad, I mean, there's got to be a real need for people with the skills that John's teaches and the program teaches.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really a labor shortage right now in the construction trades across the country, and we're really lucky to have this great program that really provides excellent training. John and I were talking before the show. I mean, my production manager, who serves on the board now at Madison College for this program, and who hires and fires my production staff, he's a graduate of that program.
All right.
And we currently have two recent graduates on staff. So I'm a big advocate, and so they
learn a ton of things, and probably including tiny houses. John, how do tiny houses fit into your program?
Well, it turns out tiny homes are a perfect fit for us. We have to, if you're going to teach how to build something, you've got to build it, right? And tiny home is a perfect size project for us to finish in our 1 year or two semesters programs. So they frame the entire thing, the floor, the walls, the roof. Hang the drywall. They install the flooring, the cabinetry. They do all the work on it except for the electrical and the plumbing. So it's a great little laboratory experiment. And why tiny homes work specifically well for us is we can build them right in the yard right next to our school. And so we can talk about things in the classroom, go in the lab, learn how to do things, and then walk right outside and work in this tiny home. And when it's finished, we keep it to a size so it's easily transportable pretty much anywhere in the state.
And they get moved, and someone eventually buys and moves into those homes then, I assume.
Absolutely. And that's where it's win-win all around. Whoever buys it gets a very well-built small home for just the cost of materials. You know, there has to be some patience.
Good deal.
It's a really good deal. And we're currently actually working with on a project that's really exciting here in Madison. It's called the Garver Feed Mill Project. They're going to put 50 tiny homes in the back lot of the Garber Feed Mill Project, and they're going to be renting them out as micro lodges.
Yeah.
So people who are interested in seeing what a tiny home is like can actually come there and rent one or two or three of them for a day or a week and move in and kind of see how they feel. You know, where do you go? If you're interested in a tiny home, where do you go to try it, right? You want to buy a car, you go to the car lot, you drive them around. I like this one. Everybody likes the idea of tiny homes, but where to go to try one? And this is kind of one of the things they're going to do. It's really pretty exciting. So we're building our tiny homes right now to go over there.
Chad, tiny homes, they seem to be, to me, I think about it, this could be a good answer to some housing problems. I know Detroit has a tiny home program for low-income folks to become homeowners.
Mm-hmm.
What other uses have you heard about?
Well, it's true that in a number of cities, I know Seattle has a similar program where, you know, the city will acquire a lot, and it's a great way to provide housing for people that are in transition or that are struggling with homelessness. And it's for those that are just looking to live more affordably. Of course, it's just it's a different concept. I mean, we have, over the past, you know, few generations have adopted, as you said in the opening, a pretty large footprint for homes. And this is not typical. I mean, you can go to Europe where some of these countries have a higher standard of living, but a much smaller typical home. And so, you know, we put a lot in, we're accustomed to having really large homes. And so the tiny house movement is a pretty strong reaction against that. It's also interesting just to think about living in 1,000 square feet, which I'm about to start doing. And I'll tell you, I mean, you know, when you go down, when you cut the size of your home in half, you know, it's a big change. But once you start doing that, it gets easier and easier to go smaller because you realize really there are only a few things you need to live comfortably.
So. Yeah, I think about the basement of my home now. I mean, there are a lot of boxes down there that are just sitting there that I haven't opened since I moved into the place.
Right.
And they should be going, and that's what it really forces you to do, I'm sure, in your case.
Correct.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, there are some questions relating to tiny homes, so let's take one. Joe in Rockford, Illinois, has a question. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
What's on your mind today?
I purchased a home that was built, a property built with a house on it in the 1800s, and we have a summer kitchen on the property that is just maybe 15 by 12, and it's sitting right on the ground, and clearly it's built with some old timbers because all the timbers are still in fine shape. But I wanted to run electricity out to it and maybe put a wall heater in it and just use it as sort of another bedroom, not have plumbing or water or anything out there. What I'm wondering, can I lift that a couple feet off the ground, build like a brick foundation underneath it, and just set it on that brick foundation? Or am I going to have to dig 4 feet underground and put in footings and or put it on a slab?
Okay, John, let's turn to you for that.
Well, there's a couple issues at stake here, and Chad can speak to one, and I'll speak to the other first. Is can you do it? Yes, you can. You can lift a structure up and dig out below and put a foundation in. I've done it. It's been done. You have to find just the right contractor to do that. The thing that Chad ought to speak to is there's zoning issues there. What do you think about that, Chad?
Yeah, so, I mean, essentially what you have right now is an outbuilding or, you know, a shed. Yeah. And depending on what the municipal codes are, you know, you may need to gain a special permission to turn that into that kind of apartment or office flat that you'd be making it.
Yeah, that might be the first question, is talking to the municipality before you do anything, right?
Correct.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. So I'm thinking about tiny homes now. Most of them, I assume, do not. They're on a foundation of some sort, but do they ever have basements?
Sure thing. You can do, and we've done it. Where it gets tricky is the stairway takes up a fair amount of square footage of the floor.
And
that's
of course
where things get tricky, is square footage is pretty precious in small homes. So either you have to plan for in advance and figure where that stairway is going to go. Or in some cases, you can do an exterior stairway. If it's just going to be a mechanical room, the problem with that, of course, is if it's the middle of winter and you want to do laundry, you don't have to put on a coat, right?
Yeah.
So it does increase the footprint of your house a bit to fit that stairway in. But absolutely, you can put a tiny home on a full foundation if you so desire. But in this day and age, there are a lot of compact appliances which you can put in. You can get a washer and a dryer in. It's stacked and fits in a closet. You can use a tankless hot water heater. There's ways around that issue. And if it's just a storage issue, well, you know, it goes back to those boxes in the basement, right? And I can't speak to that.
Understood, for sure. Well, we have more callers online. Gary is up next with a question for you. But before we go to Gary, I wanted to ask, are there, you know, when I'm thinking about remodeling or when I'm thinking about building, there's a certain sort of a standard in terms of cost per square foot of, let's say, a new construction. Is the cost per square foot pretty much the same, or do we have to, are there maybe additional costs associated with a smaller home?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, Larry. I mean, so one way to think about it, I always like to use a car analogy when we talk about the cost of remodeling. Mm-hmm. You know, with a car, as with a tiny home or any home, there are going to be certain things that have to be there. You know, there's going to be the kitchen and a bathroom. And so those all have a certain kind of inherent cost.
Yeah.
That said, the devil's always in the details. And just like with a car, you know, you have a $15,000 car and you have a $100,000 car. Yeah. So, you know, I think the typical kind of starter or mass-produced tiny house is going to be built, you know, at a pretty affordable rate, comparable to that of a typical home that would be built out in, you know, the typical development for a square footage cost. And I'm not a home builder, so I'm hesitant to talk about what we would expect is a cost per square foot for a new home.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not unusual for people to be spending $150 to $200 a square foot for a new home.
Sure.
And then, you know, it can go up from there.
Yeah, certainly. And you're probably looking then at the same, about $150, $200 a square foot for the tiny home?
Around there, but believe it or not, a little on the higher end, for the simple reason that you still have a kitchen. You still have a bathroom.
Yeah, that's right.
Those are the most expensive things, right?
Right.
So you have less square footage in the living room and not much of a dining room. So actually the square footage cost is on the higher end, but you still pay less.
Still paying way less.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's take a call from Claire in Ogama, Wisconsin. Claire, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for having me on. I have two questions. I've been thinking about tiny houses for a while, and it seems like the bottleneck for me with that is I want to move out of my A-frame, which is hard to keep warm. That's one question, how do you keep an A-frame warm? And then another thing is if I move into this tiny house, then in the winter I need to figure out something about water and sewer. So how do you handle that? All the tiny houses I see are like, you know, in a warm place and maybe they're, I don't know what. They got that figured out there.
Yeah.
But winter in Wisconsin is my question.
Yeah, okay.
Well, those are great questions. You know, as far as the issue of keeping any house warm, you know, quality air sealing in conjunction with the appropriate materials to insulate it are going to go a long way, no matter what the age of the home or the size. And a lot of times, you know, when we talk about this a lot on this show, you know, the building codes just specify that certain amounts of material be there or certain types of material, but there's nothing that tests that it's properly installed or that the house is as tight as it should be. And so that lack of oversight that has been traditional in our building history has left a lot of homes a lot draftier than they should be. And also our understanding of how to do things properly and what's important has changed over the years. But it is possible to have any home tested. We often advocate partnering with the Home Performance Program and have one of their certified Evaluators come in and look at your home and give you recommendations for how it can be significantly improved in comfort and efficiency. And then, of course, you know, you've got to weigh the value of making those improvements. But pretty typically, of all the things you can do to a home, air sealing and insulating are going to have the quickest payback and also the greatest you know, kind of payback in your happiness, because no one is unhappy to have a house that's cozier and cheaper to heat and cool. So.
And I wonder, things like solar, is there some advantage to a tiny house when it comes to things like solar heating, for example, or something like?
Absolutely. You can orient windows. You can get a lot of solar gain, and it can help a lot. It's still not the main way you would heat or cool your home, but you can get more glass area per square foot, let's say, which can help. But you know, on those minus 15 degree days, that only goes so far.
Right.
I believe the other question was involving, like, how does a tiny home have its mechanicals run to it? And that's a great question. It's one of the bigger problems that we have to solve. And we've got some good ideas, but so you buy a tiny home, you don't necessarily want to put it on a full foundation. Okay, you put it up on piers, concrete piers or something along those lines, but then how do you bring your mechanicals in, your sewer, your water, and electrical? The electrical is pretty straightforward, but the sewer and water is a little tricky. And, you know, what we've come upon and what we've worked in is essentially you have a small section of the house, and hopefully your design has the kitchen and the bathroom and everything kind of more or less in a central area. And then below that, you create a space that goes down into the soil deep enough where you can bring your water and your sewer and everything in, and you have to make that into a somewhat of a conditioned space so it doesn't freeze in winter. And so there can be some additional things you have to figure out along those lines, but that seems to be the best way to make it work.
Okay, but it can work for sure.
Yes, it can.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and John Stefani, who is Program Director and Instructor at Madison Area Technical College, looking at tiny homes, but also taking your home improvement questions for your bigger home, too. Here on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller again with Jill Nadeau, our producer, on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at tiny homes today and answering your home improvement questions as well with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build and John Stefani from Madison Area Technical College Construction and Remodeling Program. Great to have both of them here. Questions for them, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And let's go back to the phones. Gary in Appleton, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I have a question on the house built before they have the vapor barrier in the house. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to insulate it and take the siding off, what can you put on it to really put a good layer of insulation on the outside of the studs and not have a water barrier problem?
Okay.
Vapor barrier out.
Sure. Well, that's a great question, and I'll take a moment to speak about the difference between a vapor barrier and a rain plane, because in Wisconsin, typically our vapor barrier is installed on the warm side of the house or the heated side of the home, the interior, and so typically that the old way of doing it was a craft paper that was connected to the insulation batting as it was put into the wall. A lot of times now a plastic Visqueen product is installed, and there's some higher tech products that we like to use that called membrane, which essentially allows for a little bit of permeability when you need it. But that keeps moisture from driving in as vapor into the wall and condensing on the cold exterior. But then you've got the exterior, and we have to keep water out of a home. And so that's where the old material was a tar paper that was put on homes underneath whatever the siding or brick. Yeah. And then So I want to distinguish between those two things. And so when it's a great opportunity to have the exterior of the home that you can wrap in insulation, but we have to be careful that you really don't have a vapor barrier on the inside of your home. Because if you do, you don't want to create another vapor barrier on the outside of the home. So things like tar paper or Tyvek, they actually allow vapor to pass out of the wall when it needs to. And that's important. If you put up something that is vapor impermeable, the walls, whenever moisture gets into them and condenses, it'll rot because the moisture has no ability to get out. And that's the sort of building failure that we see a lot of times when those details haven't been managed. So I apologize if that answer was a little complicated. I hope, does that make sense? Or
I guess I was wondering if you wanted to add, like, let's say a R3 or R4, five, you know, nailed on the outside of the studs.
Sure.
Or something that would insulate yet let moisture pass out.
Right. So that's also a great question. So when we put insulation on the outside of a home, the safest thing to do is really to put a thick, continuous layer of insulation along the lines of 3 to 4 inches of a foam board that's going to give you an R15 to R20. And what that's going to do is that's going to prevent the wall that's inside of that thermal layer from ever getting cold enough for condensation to occur. The danger we have when we put up 1 inch of foam board is that we're still going to be getting condensation, and that foam board might act as a vapor barrier. And so it's tricky. And that's, again, this is one of these lessons we've learned in recent decades, that we think we're doing the right thing by putting foam board up, but we have to be pretty thoughtful about the whole system that we are altering and whether or not that house is going to continue to perform in a way that we all expect. Does that help? So,
yes.
And then there are things you have to do to then attach the siding or whatever material you're putting up on the home to make sure it doesn't fall off of the home. I mean, you're not going to just be nailing through all that foam. You're going to have to install some sort of a furring strip out there, and that has to be thoughtfully applied so that it's secure and isn't going to sag. But then you can really knock it out of the park when you're able to put on this thick layer of insulation.
Yeah. All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Willie and Barneveld up next. Let's go there. Let's see if I can get him on. Willie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Great program. A few months ago, I was visiting some old hippie friends from the 70s, largely, and they live in a geodesic dome built out here in the Driftless area.
Yep.
And the conversation raged a lot about the place they lived in, and we talked about how could you minimalize this larger structure, make it a lot cheaper. And what we sort of came up with, you know, along with some good wine we were drinking, was the idea that you could take it all the way down to, and it would be very easy to construct. You could construct it on the same kind of construction jigs if it was going to be mass-produced. Why not a regular dodecahedron and live in that? They could be various sizes. And you could build, you know, each of the 12 slabs of them could be built in the same production kind of thing and have variances so that they could be quickly assembled and used and, you know, in many different possible ways. We laughed about the idea altogether and wondered if people could stand living in something that small or if you could make a dodecahedron that large. Yeah, it was kind of amusing, and I wondered what you guys think. Is it,
is it possible? Okay, well, John,
to you. Well, I'll tell you, you know, you have a glass of wine or a bottle of beer, and some amazing ideas often do come out. It's true. Can you do it? Absolutely. It's been done. There was a movement in the 70s along those lines, and your friends may very well be living in one of the outputs of that. So can you do it? Yes, and there still are places that are doing it. And the advantage, of course, is you have one shape and you just fasten them all together and you don't need as much skill to figure out how to cut a rafter and how to build walls. And it goes together much more simple. But the part about it that gets tricky is you're living in a dome. And I think a lot of people are like, well, that's cool, but I don't want to live in a dome. For various reasons. One of them is you invariably end up with a lot of wasted space, places you can't use, places that are hard to get into. Some people are fine with that. You know, you work around it, you figure out how to use it. We humans, we like our rectilinear shapes and spaces. And why don't you see more things like geodesic domes? I would say the answer to that is most people live in this kind of house or that kind of house, or they have friends and they go, well, that's what I want to have. I think a lot of people haven't had the opportunity to see a geodesic home and live in it and try it and go, hey, this is kind of cool. I like what this is about. So that's part of it. It really hasn't taken off. Can you make this work? You know, there is something called SIPs, and SIPs are called structurally insulated panels, and they're like giant Legos of foam insulation and plywood. And you can basically plug a house together with them, which it's another form of that thing you're talking about. So there is movement in the industry along these lines, but it's still kind of on the fringe. So can you do it? Absolutely, especially if a beer or a glass of wine is involved.
You know, I remember back in those days, the Wisconsin or the Forest Products Lab designed round homes, and there were some real advantages. And frankly, I had a girlfriend at the time that I was in a round home, and it was kind of cool for me because round homes can take away the hallway space.
Hallway right. space and strength. Round shapes are actually a lot stronger than rectangular shapes. So there's, you know, wind strength and wind loading really helps.
Right.
Yeah, but they never really seem to take off. I think for the reasons you were talking about, people look at their friend's house that it's a, you know, rectangular house, and they want one like that.
I do want to add, and John alluded to this, you know, it is becoming increasingly popular to think about modular homes and, you know, factory-produced homes, and this is a way both to make a house more cost effectively, because, you know, when you think about it, I mean, home building is a very, even though when you're building standardized housing, if you are constructing that piece by piece on site, you know, that is a specialized craft. It's almost like every one of those homes is a custom built home, even yeah. if they are all very similar. But when you do something in a factory, I mean, imagine building a car in your garage, right? I mean, that's how a home is built, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So but we build most things in factories where you can automate it and there's much more control of the environment. You're not dealing with weather and all these other factors that disrupt and add cost to building a home or doing a remodel of a home. So, you know, there is movement out there, and as houses become smaller, it makes it easier to contemplate building them in a factory and reducing some of those costs and ultimately giving something that's of higher quality where there's a more quality control possible.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
Thanks, Willie. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Jerry in Eau Claire next. Jerry, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, me and my wife own a small farm, and we'd like to have a space for our visitors when they come, and maybe even Airbnb when we don't have friends that are coming to visit. We were thinking of building a couple little cordwood structures and maybe having them as tiny homes without bathrooms, without kitchens. You know, if they want a shower, they can come into the main house, but somewhere where they can go and stay, maybe a small wood stove or something like that in there. Or, you know, nothing too over the top, but something that's cozy. And I'm wondering if you have any advice.
Mm-hmm. Personally, I love cordwood construction. And I, you know, have a little dream of when I go into some semi-retirement of doing almost exactly what you're speaking of. I have a good friend who, they did that exact thing. They built an outlying building at their property up in up in Green Bay area, and they did a cordwood, and they rented out for that exact same thing, and it works really great. They found someone in the area who was familiar with cordwood construction, who did some of the work for them, but they also did a fair amount of the work themselves, because it's pretty low tech, but it's really pretty neat. And what's amazing is the building science of it works, because the cordwood is put in longitudinally, so any moisture can find its way out through the wood grain. It expands and contracts, but it all is controlled, and they really are pretty fantastic. The downside to them is they don't have quite as good of an overall R value. It's good, but it's not as good as what we can achieve in other ways, but it really adds, you know, it's a beautiful structure for sure. And so you pour a concrete slab, and you can build just about any cordwood structure that you could through typical framing details.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And take some more calls. Paul in Appleton up next. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, and thanks for the guest. A question. I was on the phone with Jill, so I missed how many inches with the remote wall theory putting on the exterior for insulation, and also air changes per hour. What's their goal?
For a tiny home or for just for any home? I wonder if it's the same for a tiny home that it is for, say, a standard size home.
It is. I mean, there are basic standards that we seek to achieve with any size structure. And so we're typically, in our climate, and I will just say that how you detail the exterior of a building is climate specific, but in all of Wisconsin, as best I know at the moment, I do things in southern Wisconsin, but we're looking at requiring at least an R15, R20 to be absolutely certain that you have a exterior shell that will prevent condensation or the dew point from being reached inside the wall. So that's that answer to that question. And as far as ventilation goes, I always rely on my technical, home performance evaluator for that information. So I don't want to, spew off the wrong data. But there are standards for air exchange in a home for a certain exchanges per hour. And it's a good thing to talk about and understand because, when we want to control the environment in our homes, whether it's a 100-square-foot home or a 3,000-square-foot home, and it used to be that old houses were so leaky, that you got fresh air all the time. And now we've made them much tighter, which is a good thing. It allows us to be more efficient and to retain heat and not be uncomfortable. But then we have to make sure that we're getting some fresh air so that we can breathe and be healthy. And so the upshot is that as we've made houses tighter, we've had to design systems to provide the fresh air that used to be accidental. So an important concept for people to understand, and it's a great question.
Yeah. John, to add to that?
Chad is absolutely correct. We do follow the same standards that all home builders do. And personally, for our program specifically, we've tried to exceed the Energy Star ratings, and we shoot for about 0.5 ACHs, more or less, or we try to actually exceed that. We're working to get down to 0.2, which I believe is the passive house standard. We're not quite at passive house levels, but we're shooting for it. We're actually working based on net zero energy standards, which is a U.S. government project. So there are actually standards out there to build a net zero home. We build our tiny homes to all be net zero ready. And what that means is that they're so tight and so highly insulated that you can put a solar array on the roof that would produce as much energy as the house uses, thus net energy zero. And it's a great standard to go to. There's a lot of standards out there right now. There's passive house, net zero, LEED, green built. It's dizzying. And, and Chad can probably speak to it. It's hard to know which standard to follow. So we kind of chose net zero because it's attainable for us and our students. And then we also involve the electrical apprentices who will wire the house for a solar array, and making them net zero seems like a pretty sexy thing to do.
Yeah, for sure.
And so, you know, and to translate something that John just threw out, so for 0.2 ACH, what that literally means is you've got a fifth of an air exchange per hour, which translates into turning over the air in the home every 5 hours completely. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Let's go to Carol in Madison next. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Two questions. One is, do you teach your students how to make an off-grid package for the tiny homes, like black water systems and composting toilets and that kind of thing? And then the other question is, what is the best placement for a tiny home as far as east, west, north, south with your main windows to collect the best light and temperatures?
Excellent questions, for sure. One of the tiny homes we built in the last couple of years was for a young couple who took our program, and they did a trailer-based tiny home, mm-hmm. about 210 square feet. And so these are the exact same things they were doing. So currently, Wisconsin code does not allow for composting toilets.
It's true.
They don't. The code doesn't. And this is where it gets a little tricky. And so they built it on a trailer with axles, so it doesn't have to follow the UDC anymore. But it depends on the municipality, right? Because some municipalities will say, well, if you've got a trailer, quote unquote, on your property, they require you to move it every 6 months. Not everyone does. So you start out with the municipality you're working with and find out what their rules are. And if it's somewhere pretty far north or central, they may be a little less stringent on their rules. So it really depends. So this young couple did indeed put a composting toilet in. And they actually, they made a shower based off of a small sheep watering bin was their shower base. And they're planning on doing a lot of gray water recovery and using it. And they're going to do a well to get their water in. And so they're figuring that one out as they go along. And I mean, the area they're working in does not require them to move their trailer. So they're putting it up on jacks, and we actually express that they really need to tie it to the ground for high wind, and they're going to do that. And they're meeting a lot of the building codes, but the composting toilet is a tricky thing.
And I'll just add that in the city of Monona here, which is surrounded by Madison, small municipality, we passed an ordinance allowing for composting toilets back about 8 years ago. And I was involved with that as a member of the city council. And it's what's fascinating about this, and important to always keep in mind, is a lot of these codes exist for the health and safety of the general public. And so, you know, there's a reason why we want to keep, you know, contaminated water separate from potable water, and many other issues where we want to maintain health and safety. And so we always have to tread very carefully when we start making those exceptions. And yet, as we all know, and I really appreciate your call and questions, you know, there are a lot of these things that if we do them well and do them properly, it's much more sustainable. You can live more independently. We're not all dependent on these municipal systems that then lead us susceptible to all sorts of catastrophes or challenges. So, you know, we're at this great moment where we're struggling with how to loosen up some of these rules to allow us to do things in a way that uses less resources. So it's a great question.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking home improvement today and the tiny house movement as well with our two guests, Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build, John Stefani, program director at MATC, Madison Area Technical College's Construction and Remodeling Program. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with Chad Spade and John Stefani about home improvement issues and the tiny house movement. All our lines are filled, so we're going to go right back to the phones and to Karen in Milwaukee, I believe, is next. Let's see if I can get her on. Karen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I just wanted to give you my opinion of, or I've been in a tiny home for my husband and I for over 25 years. We're in a concrete block home that the living space is just a few feet shy of 400 square feet.
Okay.
As my mother always said, you have too much interest for living in a small house. You know, every square inch is used, and it's a testament to our marriage that we didn't divorce.
Yeah.
But we really didn't have a problem except for all of our interests. So we have rented for many years, you know, a large studio that we can do our woodworking and our art studio and, you know, store all our camping equipment and all this other stuff. So, you know, it's fine to, I guess, live in. You can't, like, I think there's, I don't see how anyone could, like, not accumulate anything to where, you know, you're going to just be filled up and need more space. I mean, we don't have a garage, or we didn't have a, you know, we don't have a basement, so we literally did have to find spaces, you know, to accommodate the things that we weren't using day to day, or, you know, things to, like our, like I say, our art shop, studio and workshop. So, and I'm also amazed with, I don't know how much, I look at these small, tiny houses, and they talk about how much they cost. There's some of them $45,000, and I'm like, how in the world would it cost $45,000? My husband built a shed 8x12 for, you know, $1,600 for materials, and even if you put in a stove or a microwave or whatever, I just don't see how, if you can afford $45,000 for a small home, you might as well, you know, get a slightly bigger house for not that much more. So I was amazed at the prices that are charged for small homes.
Well, I'm glad you called to share your experiences, Karen. I think some pretty interesting. John, do you want to comment?
Well, so I'm a little embarrassed because the recent iteration of a tiny home we built was about 440 square feet, and it ended up costing around $40,000, more or less, when it was all said and done. And I know that may sound surprising, but, you know, what Chad and I were discussing earlier is we did build it to very strict energy standards, and we were putting in modern appliances, you know, a modern kitchen and bathroom. And when it all added up, you know, we used a metal roof instead of composite shingles. So we did a better quality, and that is where it comes in. So if you go to the big box stores and buy their least expensive materials, you can put something together for a lot less. But, you know, as we like to say, you're going to get what you pay for.
And the cost, as you said earlier, the cost of the kitchen and the cost of the bathroom, those are where your high costs are.
Right, and the other thing, too, that, you know,
regardless of the size of the house.
Right, but then also, a lot of times when we talk about cost, and I think the caller, you know, talked about the $1,600 shed that her husband built.
Yeah.
Right? Well, you know, when you buy a tiny house, you don't build it out of a pile of materials that get shipped to your home. You know, you're buying something that's been assembled, and labor is always the most expensive part. Now, if you're a do-it-yourselfer, that's great. You can save yourself a lot of money. But, you know, John, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but that $40,000 was the material cost.
Yes, it was.
Of that. So, you know, you could not, as a consumer, buy a $40,000, 400-square-foot tiny house that was of the quality that John built in his program, because all the labor that would have gone into that as well probably added, you know, twice as much again. So,
and I think that, you know, when you watch the shows, the tiny house show on TV, for example.
Oh boy. Don't get me started on those.
Well, they're talking about, oh yeah, we built this for $45,000, but they're not charging their labor.
That's correct. it really, so those shows, there's a really big caveat in those shows, is they are produced to be good TV, primarily first. And they really don't necessarily reflect the reality when it comes to building your own tiny home. They gloss over a lot of details that are really very important that both Chad and I would easily agree on. So you have to be careful there. The other aspect I would like to speak to is she talks about a 400-square-foot home. It's true. I guess a good way to think about this is when we build these, I look at these, and they're very similar to a standard large one-bedroom apartment. So if you feel you could easily live in a one-bedroom apartment, and say maybe you're a boomer and your kids have all moved out, and you found a storage shed like she had for your stuff or your interests, can you live in that one-bedroom apartment you maybe lived in when you first got together? If you think of it in those terms, it might help you to realize what you're getting into.
Yeah, that sounds. Thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate your call, Karen. And we'll take some more calls as well. Let's go to Pam in Viroqua now. Pam, hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for being there. I have a construction question. A friend used a piece of heavy equipment to drop a bucket full of gravel where I wanted it, but that involved rolling past within 4 feet of my cinder block foundation when the ground was pretty wet. And a neighbor had the same issue, and she had discovered that it had cracked her cinder block foundation because the heavy equipment had compressed the ground. And she has the advantage of having an uncovered cinder block wall, but mine is insulated. So the inside is insulated and the outside is underground. So my question is there a way to check and see if my wall got cracked? And do I need to worry about that?
Well, these are great questions. Thanks for calling. So certainly in the big picture, we would want to be mindful of whether or not your foundation is deteriorating. But if there's a crack in it, the odds are pretty good that you're going to start to see some water infiltration in the basement. And I don't know if you have a sump system or a drain tile or anything like that, but a lot of times a cinder block foundation will not have that unless you've retrofitted it.
I was careful to buy a home that is pretty dry in the basement. So What happens after the heaviest rains is I will have some seepage at some points, but it all self-drains and there's never any standing water.
Okay. Well, so what I would encourage you to do is to continue to monitor that situation. And if it really seems like it's gotten worse, particularly over on that side of the home where the equipment was moving, then the good news is that because you don't have the foam on the, I mean, if the foam had been on the outside of the foundation, which would be a perfectly good place to have it, it would have absorbed probably the compression of that soil. So it would have probably protected the foundation, but it would have been hard to see if it had done that. You could, if there is a problem, have things excavated out there and have it repaired if necessary. So, you know, there is a fix to the problem, but chances are your home will be okay. And if you don't see any change in that water infiltration, you probably can just rest assured that you're fine.
Yeah, there you go. I was thinking back to the lake home that I had where there was a driveway put in that ran right next to the side of the house. And then a couple of years later, when I'm having some remodeling done, the remodeler tells me, you know, your wall is leaning in, probably from the pressure from that construction, and I had to put in a new wall. A new basement wall.
Sure.
Yeah, and actually, I was surprised. It was expensive, but not as expensive as I thought it was going to be. Let's put it that way.
Yeah,
but
that's a tricky operation, even at its best.
Yeah, even at its best. But it was another one of those surprises you really don't want to have. Right. Let's go to, thanks again, Pam. Let's go to Eric in Superior next. Eric, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a simple question related to what you talked about, exterior walls and the bleeding of moisture or the transfer of the humidity through the wall to the exterior. What's your opinion of cellulose dry packed when the scrim is put on the inside? I would stay away from the wet application, put the scrim on the inside, use a 2x6 wall, put the cellulose in with the blown application, and then with a typical OSB sheeting on the outside, I've heard that OSB, if it were to be tested, might be actually rated as a vapor retarder. So what do you think of the dry pack cellulose wall?
Great question. So OSB is a vapor retarder. I'm not sure exactly what its spec is, but it approaches being, you know, a vapor barrier, and so it is problematic because when it's located on the outside, we often find that it is rotting on the outside of these homes that were built. And again, if the details aren't right and the moisture gets in the wall, it's going to get blocked on that OSB and it's going to rot. So you still have to have a good vapor barrier. We do not use OSB. We use plywood because it has different qualities, and it's also structurally superior to OSB. Having that exterior vapor barrier would be problematic unless you have that thick exterior layer of foam that's going to prevent the OSB from ever becoming wet, where condensate's forming on it. And in that case, you could use the cellulose dense packed on the inside and not have a vapor barrier on the interior. The vapor barrier would move to the middle of the wall, and that's actually would be the best way for a high performance home to be built.
Excellent. Thank you so much for that call, Eric. Appreciate it. Visiting today with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison, John Stefani, Program Director and Instructor at Madison Area Technical College Construction and Remodeling Program. They'll be with us till 12:30, so give a call and we'll be back after the news. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Design Build of Monona and Madison, John Stefani, Program Director and Instructor at MATC's Construction and Remodeling Program. Talking home improvements, we're talking tiny homes as well. Give us a call with your questions or comments or maybe experiences at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Chad, I want to go back to you for a minute because if people have questions and are interested in working on home construction and so forth or remodeling, the NARI show is coming up in Madison.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Larry. So next weekend, January 19th through the 21st, at the Madison Marriott Convention Center, which is out on the west side of Madison, the NARI Remodeling Expo is happening, and it's a great event. There will be dozens of remodeling contractors there that you can walk through and talk about projects and get to know us. And then, of course, many suppliers and, electricians, plumbers, people from all aspects of the trades. The Home Performance Program is always there. Talk about efficiency. There are a lot of seminars. The seminars are free. There'll be over 45 seminars, and various people are presenting. So it's always a lot of fun, free parking. Of course, yeah. It's exhausting for those of us that are there.
But it's now, what's the dates again? Or?
It is Friday through Sunday, the 19th through the 21st. And it's you can go online to nariexpo.com to get the details. But on Friday, it's from 2 to 7. From Saturday, it's from 9 to 6. And on Sunday, the 21st, it's from 10 to 4.
There we go. Andy emailed to ask, what are the standards for building a tiny home in Madison? Are they, John, you want to?
Well, it's an interesting question because the first part of that is, well, exactly which standards? As far as building standards go, we still follow the UDC, the Uniform Dwelling Code, which is the state code. The state of Wisconsin actually is in charge of all the building standards, and all municipalities have to follow it. So we follow that to a minimum, but quite honestly, we exceed that by quite a bit, which, you know, as Chad would speak to, most builders really should. The building standards, the UDC, is the bare minimum, and if you don't build even to that, you're actually building an illegal house. So it's we build to exceed the UDC code structurally and energy-wise. So structurally, it's a very, very sound house. We're also trying to use modern and upcoming techniques. For instance, we do 2-foot on center framing. It saves lumber, creates more space for insulation, and it is as strong or stronger than 16-inch on center. The standards for insulation, there's where we chose a standard, what we call net zero ready, and we worked with an energy rater, like Chad was talking about earlier. We actually work with an energy rater to look at all of our assemblies and decide how we're going to build them. Are we going to go 2x4 with 6 inches of foam insulation on the outside, or do we do 2x6 with 2 inches of insulation? We look at all the models, and he adds them all up together to see how much energy the house will use and how big of a solar array we need. The current iteration we're doing 2 inches of foam insulation on the exterior, and then 2x6s with dense pack cellulose for the wall. We put the weather resistant barrier on the outside of that and set our windows and everything to the outside of that line. So it can change by your design. So it really is a design issue more than anything, depending on what you want.
And then I want to add that zoning is a really critical issue of compliance. And John and I were talking at the break that, you know, a lot of municipalities require a single family residence to have 1,000 square feet or more. And those can vary, but, you know, you can't just plop down a 400 square foot home without getting some permissions in a typical residential development. And so that's something that we have to look at changing.
Sure.
Zoning laws and thinking outside the box. I mean, of course, it's not uncommon when you go into most developments, houses tend to be of a similar size. So I think the future holds for, you know, some tiny home developments where, you know, a lot of people are living in smaller footprint homes, and different yard sizes is what we would expect in that sort of development.
Interesting. Going back to the standards for passive homes, Michael emailed to say that the passive home standard for infiltration is 0.6, not 0.2.
That is absolutely correct, and I stand corrected. I did have a different metric in my mind, but that is indeed the case. And 0.6 is really a very, very high standard. It's really quite excellent, and it's achievable, but it's tough. So we actually, we've been going for one air change per hour was our standard, and I apologize for that I misspoke there.
Well, we have callers online. Maybe we should take a call here. Todd in Menominee up next. Todd, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got a question. We built our home 38 years ago. I built it myself, logged the property, totally a scratch-built home where we built the windows and all that things. And back then, I built it with two by six stud wall system, 24-inch on center, and I applied 1 inch of rigid insulation. However, during the years, that insulation had shrunk, so we were starting to get, you know, varmints in. So I stripped all that, and I put plywood on the studding on the outside, and I had 2 inches of rigid foam followed by some shingles. Now, the next thing is I want to insulate our roof. Our roof is 2x12, and it's a cathedral ceiling. So it's vented, and I'm wondering whether the best course is to get rid of the venting system and put in 2 inches of rigid insulation on top of the roof.
Well, first off, kudos
you.
To you. Yeah, like, I mean, yeah. We were all looking at each other amazed here. That sounds wonderful. I'm jealous. So you have a few options. It certainly would behoove you to put the foam up on the roof deck, and you have two ways to go. I mean, the ideal situation is that you add that continuous foam, put down a furring strip, and then allow for that ventilation just below the new roof decking. I mean, that's ideal. But though typically you are going to want to have a 4-inch foam layer up on the roof, because once we get to the roof, we really have to go thick with our exterior shell. Another option is that you could put, if you're going to be exposing this from the inside, you could apply a spray foam in the cavity, and you could either go to a hot roof assembly where you don't have the ventilation, but because you have 12 inches, you have the luxury of putting in like a cardboard
chute,
like a baffle, mm-hmm. to allow that ventilation to continue to occur just below the roof deck, and then foam in 5 to 6 inches of foam that will give you the R value you need on that roof deck, and then, reinstall whatever the interior finish material is.
Yeah, we've decided that we don't want to attack from the inside because we have wood boards up.
Okay, okay.
Virtual nightmare. The other thing with our roof, with the foam problem, and I'm wondering if I could put some condensed glass pack in my rafters. The other problem when I designed our home, it's not four-sided, it's five-sided. Not all five sides are equal with more southern exposure. But I have a background in art and boat building. So when I built our house, every rafter's at a different pitch. So we actually have a curved roof that's built like a boat hull, really.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
So
well, that's interesting. You might, so you've got a curved roof. Well, okay, what Chad said is true. The foam on the outside is the way to go. Mm-hmm. You might have to stack up multiple layers of thinner material that more easily bends.
Yeah, and I've heard that's a problem. Years ago, 10 years ago, we built a cabin over on a lake, and we bought 10 inches of rigid insulation with the OSB on one side, and we screwed that down to the 2x6 roof decking. And that seems to be a superb roof, but I have read about multiple layers are not the way to go.
Yeah, no, because you have a curve, that really does limit you. You have to have something that has some flexibility, and so
right.
The 6-inch with the skin of OSB is not going to flex.
Right, right.
So multiple layers of 1-inch or even maybe 3/4-inch, and screw them all down till you get that R value you want, and then like Chad was saying, put a venting in and put your plywood over top of that.
So I do have to put plywood over the styrofoam then, for certain, right?
Yeah, you need something to attach your roofing to.
Right, right. Okay.
All right, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Love to see that house.
Yeah.
No kidding. Boat builder really? Building a house. I'm a boat builder myself, but I've never had the idea of building a curved roof. Wow.
Send us a photo and put it up on our Facebook page. Will you, Todd? I'd love to see that.
No doubt.
Really would.
Yeah,
thank
definitely.
You. Well, here we have Sam and Eau Claire next. Sam, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I don't think any of the industries involved are prepared yet, but now with the passage of the industrial hemp bill in Wisconsin, I was wondering if you could talk about building with hempcrete or any other hemp-based products.
Yeah. Well, I've heard of what you speak of, and it's really in its infancy. There are a lot of interesting products out there right now. For instance, there is a product that I've seen and we've used that's ground up wood fiber with cement that you can use for blocks for foundation. Yes, hemp is going to make inroads into our industry for sure. What is that going to look like? Yeah, it's a great fiber. So it could end up going into concrete. It could end up going into many things. I would give that a few years to figure it out. It's going to take them. I'm not a big fan, and I'm sure Chad would agree with this, is the first iteration of any new product, it's always good to give them a while to figure out the problems before you jump in.
Right, yeah. Definitely.
All right, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Melanie in Walworth, it's your turn next. Hi, Melanie.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about insulation. I have a 45-year-old ranch where the bedrooms are above the garage. The floors are so cold in the winter that it greatly affects the comfort and sleeping. Now, the garage ceiling is drywalled, so I don't know how much insulation is in there or what the R factor would be, but in looking in the aperture of a light fixture, I've seen the yellow cellulose. The beams run horizontally. My question is, could I make holes going along on either side between the beams and blow something in to further insulate, or is there a problem with adding something to something?
Well, this is a great question, and it's a common problem that many people have. The best thing to do is, if there aren't too many obstructions on that garage ceiling, just have it torn down so that everything can be observed. And depending on how much space there is, we will either blow in a spray foam or a dense pack cellulose into that space. And sometimes we do a combination of the two so that you really get a good air seal and a good appropriate R value. If you have enough space, a good thing to do, we were talking to that last caller about putting in some sort of a baffle for an airspace. If you can leave a little airspace just under the floor, it actually is a great trick that allows the floor to be warmer. But then you're going to almost definitely be working with a spray foam in that cavity. Drywall will have to be reinstalled, and often we see drywall that has all sorts of holes in it, or the seams aren't taped, and that's another source of cold air getting up into those cavities and taking away from the comfort. So if you don't have the budget to tear it all out and redo it, then certainly it is possible that blowing cellulose through holes will potentially improve the situation. It's hard to know that you've really addressed enough of the little details. So if you're working with an insulation contractor that uses infrared imaging to for quality control, that's a great and important thing to ask. It's not a do-it-yourselfer sort of project, really, because the materials that you would want to use are pretty much only installed by a professional.
There you go.
So, good luck.
Thank you so much. Good luck. Appreciate it. Laura emailed to say she's currently living in a very old farmhouse, over 100 years old, which does not seem practical for renovation because of electrical, plumbing, and structural, would have to be redone to a great extent in a situation like this. She's wondering if you recommend new construction. She has the space available to put something new up while living in the existing house. Of course, financing always a concern, so any creative suggestions you have would be appreciated.
This is a great question, and in some ways, this speaks to the dilemma that we always have when we're thinking about remodeling an old home, because it's just so much that could be done and often should be done to bring things up to a modern standard and to have it be reliable and comfortable and energy efficient and all that stuff. But it costs a fortune, when you're having to tear everything out and then put it all back together and integrate in many cases with what's there. When you build something new, you don't have to fuss around with all the old stuff. And that's why remodeling is always more expensive than building new. So there isn't an obvious right answer to this question. A lot of times that old structure has so much character and, there's often an emotional attachment that we have with the places that we've lived in for some time, and that we can't put a price tag on. Is it a purely rational economic decision to do extensive renovation? That's hard to say. I mean, that's how I make my living, so I have to be careful. But, we do have this conversation with a lot of our clients. You have to want to put that money into that home. And, of course, there's a location here. This old home or farmhouse is on a particular spot. And while you could tear it down and rebuild there, which might be the most rational thing to do economically or most cost effective, then that old place doesn't stand there anymore.
Yeah.
So,
and there's also all those materials will go to the landfill, or where do they go? So there's the green sort of aspect to that as well, is you tear this down, where does it go? What do you do with it? Absolutely. Are you in love with the house? You'll figure it out. There's definitely emotional attachment.
I was thinking about another issue. About six homes ago, or maybe seven, I was renting an old farmhouse, much like what she's talking about, and it and I moved out. But the owners eventually, it was in a rural area, and the zoning issues were such that they wanted to build a new home on the farm property, and they had to tear that home down in order to build the new home, because there was a limit to the number of homes that could be built in that because of that township, those township regulations.
Yeah, and there's septic issues and well issues to think about as
septic
well.
Septic and well issues as well. So.
Well, and you know, you just raised inadvertently a topic we were talking about in the break about how, you know, could you build two tiny houses on a typical residential lot? And in reality, you know, you'd have to rezone it. But that, since we're talking about tiny houses today, I just want to throw that in. You know, you'd have to get a municipality to allow something like that to happen. Right now in Madison, they're effectively allowing some what we would call tiny houses to be built, which are in-law suites out over garages and things. And, you know, so this is this topic is one that's very much in flux and very much affected by zoning.
The state is actually in the process of changing some of the regulations based on the tiny home movement. And I know some municipalities are as well. Mm-hmm. So it's happening. It's going on out there.
Pat from Barneveld emailed to say she has a 22-year-old home with original windows. During the last cold spell, she had blocks of ice at the bottom of several windows on the north side, needs to replace them. Should she go with a new construction window or consider inserts?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, a lot of times, you know, because this is a condensation issue, putting a removable storm one solid storm on the inside of that window is a great way to address this problem. You know, traditionally we think of storm windows as something that are on the outside of the house, but from a condensation prevention and just overall performance perspective, there's so many seams in a window that if you can put up one solid piece of glass on the inside, you're really kind of attacking that problem in the most effective way, and you're reducing the chance for the condensation within the window.
And do you take those off then in the summertime? How does it work?
You do. I mean, typically they're removed. If you're going to want to operate the window, you know, you just have to remove it. It's like an interior storm, one big piece that covers the entire window. So for a double hung sash, that's one piece of glass or plexiglass will be to the inside over the entire two sash opening.
But that would seem to be an inexpensive or less expensive way by far to deal with that problem.
That is definitely the least expensive way to effectively address the issue. The other thing is looking at the amount of condensation that's being produced in the home and ways to reduce that when it's particularly cold outside, because physics will never, the laws of physics will not be changed.
Not just a good idea. They're actually laws. Yeah.
Yes. So.
Yeah, I have had cases where I've walked into someone's house who's had this problem, and believe it or not, we solved the issue by turning down their humidifier. There are some cases where people have put humidifiers in newer homes. In this 22-year-old home, I would consider a quote-unquote newer home. And if you put a humidifier on and that thing is running, you might have excessive moisture in the air, and it could be as simple as turning a humidifier down.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, this has been a lot of fun. And the NARI, just one quick on the NARI, how's that going?
Yep, coming up next weekend, a week from tomorrow, the 19th through the 21st, on the west side of Madison at the Marriott Convention Center.
Well, Chad and John, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we have a chance to do this again. I know, Chad, for sure, you're back on March 8th.
So yes, looking forward to it. Thanks,
always
Larry.
Happy to join you.
Chad Spate, owner of Chad's Design Build of Madison and Monona. John Stefani, program director, instructor at Madison Area Technical Colleges. Construction and Remodeling Program. Great to have them along, and thank you so much for listening. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll be talking about designing and planting a kitchen garden. Stay with us. Lots in store.